My guest today is Dr. Kinda Rigdon, PhD. Dr. Rigdon holds a BS in microbiology from the University of South Florida and a PhD in microbiology and virology from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. As an educator, entrepreneur, and research scientist, she's dedicated her career to understand the complexities of the gut's microbial ecosystem and its critical role in human health and wellness. Dr. Rigdon is passionate about empowering people to achieve optimal health through informed nutrition and lifestyle choices. By the end of this episode, we hope you learn more about the gut and autism connection, yeast, the vast ecosystem of the gut, the mother's gut health, the birthing process, genetic implications tied to gut development and health, and we will also discuss melanin and Neanderthal DNA. Now, my conversation with Dr. Kinda Rigdon. But if you just want to start with giving us your background and sharing any information about your journey, that'd be great.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Well, so my PhD is in microbiology and technically virology. I studied HIV-1 in the lab. We actually would look at the growth of the virus. We would figure out certain mutations and see how that virus was infectious or not infectious. So it was fascinating to study that, but my program, I went through the Department of Microbiology, actually finishing at UAB, University of Alabama, Birmingham. From there, I went into teaching, and so I've taught upper-level science courses at the college level in several different institutions, but at one particular point, this was maybe back in 2015, for my department, I had to actually teach biology, microbiology, and anatomy in the same semester. So when that happened, it's funny because you are talking about biology and ecosystems and animals and all of that in one class, and then going across the hall teaching microbiology all about bacteria and viruses and infectious diseases. And then I would go to an anatomy class and teach about the human body and how this relates to this and the functioning of different organs and such. And it was during that time that I kind of started to put all three subjects together. And that's probably my, if I have a superpower, I have very few, but the one that I might have is connecting the dots. And so I'm very good, I think, at observation and sitting there and thinking about things and trying to see where the dots connect. And so that's what happened in this point in time in my career, is I realized here we have a gut microbiome, meaning all of the microbes that live in your gut, your intestines, your gastrointestinal tract, however you want to call it. And there are predators and prey, and one kind likes to eat the other kind, and then the yeast will make antibiotics to kill the bacteria, and then you throw in viruses and you throw in parasites and the whole mix. And it is an actual ecosystem inside of your body. And then I started to realize how all of this is happening in the gut and how it connects to different organ systems in the human, the host, and how that affects disease. And so it was just this kind of aha moment for me. And that's when I really started to dive deeper into the gut microbiome, and especially the part that I was super interested in is about yeast, which is a fungus, a single-celled fungus. And yeast, if you've been in any basic biology class, you'll learn that fungi are eukaryotes, just like we are. So our cells, our human cells, are eukaryotic because we have a true nucleus and they're organized. All the organelles are organized. And it's just, it's, evolutionarily, it's a step up from a prokaryote, which would be like bacteria. They have kind of this mess of DNA in the middle. It's more primitive and simplistic. So whenever you think about a gut microbiome having eukaryotes, for me, that would almost be like going to Africa and standing in a savanna and looking around and thinking, okay, what do I need to be cautious about? Is it the very large lion that's over there, or is it the little tiny mound of termites? It's like that with bacteria and fungus, which fungus being yeast. You always want to keep your eye on the eukaryotes because they have a lot of tools for defense and for really outcompeting anything else around them. So yeast immediately became my focus. And after that, reading a lot of different publications and books, I started to realize the role of yeast. I started with Candida albicans. Most people have heard of Candida and Candida overgrowth in the gut and how that impacts health. I started there, and then I started to learn about some other types of yeast. And it turns out we have about probably five main types of yeast that live in the gut in a typical human. And of course, it is dependent on what food you eat and where you live and all those things. But another yeast that has recently been discovered to be in the gut is called Malassezia furfur. So genus and species, Malassezia furfur. This is actually the yeast that originally they found on the skin, and it causes dandruff, and it loves to eat oil, sebum, from the human skin, because that particular yeast does not make these oils in its own, it can't make it for itself. So it has to get the oils from the host, meaning the human. And so it likes to live in an oily area with sebum or fatty acids. So this yeast, doctors used to say, oh, well, that yeast is just on the skin. It doesn't go inside the body. But as we are now learning so much more about our microbiome, not only our skin microbiome, but our gut microbiome, everything, that actually was debunked. And they found Malassezia in the gut. And actually, they found it in nearly every organ of the body. And they say that by age 15, nearly 100% of humans are inhabited by Malassezia furfur. So it's something you want to keep your eye on. It is a eukaryote. It has a lot of tricks in its toolkit. So that's where, so those are my focuses, Candida yeast and Malassezia yeast. So where does this intersect with autism and autism spectrum? For me, like, I can't help it. As a trained microbiologist, I see the world in microbial terms. It's just my natural go-to. Like, the first questions I ask are, okay, which microbes are involved? Because I know there's something. So that's been my perspective on autism. And I understand that autism is a very complex, it's a complex topic. It is not just one thing, and there are many, many factors involved. Definitely genetics plays a role. And I think that they say autism spectrum is about 80% heritable. So genetically, passed on, and it involves over 800 genes. So yeah, I mean, we could look at a million different things and say, oh, well, that might contribute to symptoms or different aspects of autism. The part that I want to focus on is the microbial connection to the genetics. So if you take genetics and say, okay, yes, certain people have genetically inherited mutations, and this may affect how the body functions. And then you take the topic of epigenetics, which is kind of it's a newer science that people are learning about. Epigenetics is epi means on top of, and genetics is your genes, your DNA. So it's not changes in the DNA bases. it's changes on top of the DNA. So the bases don't even have to change for you to have a function loss in a part of your body. And that's where epigenetics comes into play. Epigenetics, I think, is where this topic connects to environmental stimuli. And so if there are certain things in the environment that either block changes, methylation that happens in epigenetics, or maybe it promotes it, you want to look at that, because that could be important for the human that may have already a genetic predisposition. That environmental cause could make it worse or exacerbate the situation. So you could look at like parental age at conception. You could look at the perinatal environment of the womb, or the mother's health, or the mother's gut health. You could look at her levels of estrogen, progesterone, all kinds of things. I want to add this in so I don't forget about it. It looks like manganese is important. So levels of manganese in the mother, in her diet, collectively as a society in our food, we should look at that, because manganese is actually pretty special and it does some things in the gut that are important. So this is kind of my take on it, is how are we going to look at autism from a microbial perspective and link that to environment?
Okay.
So there's actually two different mutations I'd like to highlight, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and this came about actually during COVID. I was part of a group of health professionals that I think it was every 2 weeks we would get on a Zoom call and discuss. These were like doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals that were dealing with the COVID crisis in real time. And they were trying to share like, hey, here's what works for me, or here's what I found that helps. And so on these calls, I remember one of the doctors had mentioned, hey, I've noticed that in my long COVID patients, so people who were dealing with long COVID and symptoms of long COVID way after they had COVID, they were still having like micro clots and blood clots and stuff like that. He said, I've noticed something about these particular people. He said, in this group that I'm talking about, they are on the autism spectrum. They have long COVID, and there's two mutations that are interesting. They have the MTHFR mutation, and they have the PAI1 mutation. So I wanted to share a little bit about those mutations, because when he said that, I was like, wait a minute, I've never heard that before, number one. And number two, I need to know what's going on here, because yeah, that's just super important because of kind of where my head already was with thinking about autism and stuff from a microbial perspective. So let's start with MTHFR. There's a lot about this in social media. I have noticed more and more people talking about this particular mutation. I'll say the science name. It is long. We'll just get through it, and then we'll just call it MTHFR from there on. So it is the 5-10 methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. So M methylene tetra T hydro H folate F, and reductase R, MTHFR. So if you have this mutation, there's two different locations in the genome where you can have a mutation. You can have one, or you can have both, or however it kind of shuffles out. One is a little bit more potent than the other. So like if you have one of these, you're going to see more effects of it on your health versus the other. So the first mutation is the 667 C to T mutation. So a DNA base, the C, changes to a T. In the next mutation, it's still the MTHFR enzyme. It's the 1298 A to C, C as in cat, A-to-C mutation. So either you can get these from one parent or both parents. It just depends on how it shuffles for you. And I will say this is in my family, so I do have a personal interest in this particular mutation. And this is why I've studied a lot about it. So this particular enzyme, it is involved in the methylation of homocysteine to methionine. It also is involved in folate metabolism. So let me break that down to make it a little bit more simple. People who tend to have heart disease, they will have elevated levels of homocysteine in their body. Cysteine is an amino acid. Homocysteine is a version of that. It's also an amino acid. And then methionine is also an amino acid. So this particular MTHFR enzyme takes one and turns it into the other. But if you don't have that enzyme, or if it's mutated or half mutated, your enzyme's not working at 100% capacity. So you're not gonna get that homocysteine broken down into methionine like it's supposed to. So then there's potential outcomes, health outcomes from that. The other side of this is the folate. So this enzyme also takes folate, which is vitamin B9. Most people know that part of it, vitamin B9. But there's a difference between like vitamin B9 that you might see on your daily vitamin bottle, and that's usually going to be called folic acid. They also tend to add that one to products on the shelf. So like cereals, they'll say, oh, added folic acid, whatever. That is not the quote unquote healthy type of vitamin B9. That's the type typically you want to avoid. What's the more natural type for the human body is called folate. It's still vitamin B9. It's just a little bit different composition. So people who have this mutation, this MTHFR, their body cannot break down vitamin B9 into folate very well. So they're going to have a lack of vitamin B9 or folate in their body. And that has other health implications. I'm going to circle back to that later on, because there's also a connection with methionine and SAM. And SAM is involved in pigmentation, which I think is important in this topic as well. So starting out, so we've got this MTHFR mutation. A lot of people who have that mutation also have the PAI1 mutation. PAI1 stands for plasminogen activator inhibitor type 1. If you have this mutation, you are mutated in your serpine 1 gene, S-E-R-P-I-N-E. This gene provides instructions for making plasminogen activator inhibitor, or PAI1. PAI1 is associated with insulin levels. And it is involved in metabolic conditions like type 2 diabetes. So basically, this PAI1 regulates liver lipid metabolism, lipid homeostasis. Anytime you're talking about like fatty acids, lipids, PAI1 is involved. So let's say you have a mutation in your PAI1 gene, and everybody has two copies, one from mom, one from dad. The normal, not mutated, version is 5G5G. If you have a mutation, it's called 4G. So some people have one good copy and one mutated copy. Some people have both copies mutated. If you have any mutations in this gene, basically you have a lower amount of the PAI1 enzyme levels. So here's where that kind of comes in. So there's two forms of PAI1. There's PAI1 and PAI2. The PAI1 is just kind of in the whole body. PAI2 is made by the placenta only during pregnancy. So if there's a mutation there, that could be an issue. So, so these levels are regulated two ways. They're regulated by genetics. Like we just said, you could have a mutation. It's also regulated by your triglyceride levels. So that's where if you have high triglycerides, you should look into your PAI1 genetics. So people with this PAI1 mutation can commonly have issues during pregnancy. Sometimes it can be miscarriages. Sometimes it can be other pregnancy issues like placenta accreta is one of them, where the placenta kind of grows into the wall of the uterus and there's complications from that. Obesity is another issue. Insulin resistance and heart disease are all involved in this mutation. So now that we know the two mutations I wanted to highlight, first, do you have any questions? Sorry, I don't want to talk the whole time.
It's great.
Okay.
I was just shocked with the PAI and the insulin connection.
Yeah.
Because I'm just blown away by that.
Yeah, it's something that's not talked about a lot. And I actually didn't even know about it. I didn't know it existed until that friend of mine had mentioned, oh, yeah, I see this in my population of autistic patients. And it was coincidentally part of the long COVID issues because of the clotting, the microclotting that these people were experiencing. So where does this connect? Let's connect the dots. I want to kind of start with that MTHFR because studies have shown that it's approximately 24% of humans globally have this MTHFR mutation. It's more than you would think.
How is that? What's the trend of that in the last couple of decades? Do you know?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know the trend. I know that it is European and Asian predominantly. And they think that's kind of where it started. So if you are of European or Asian descent, you're going to see that show up more often in your genome than, for example, African, because it didn't, it was not spread that way through genetics. So actually, I have written down that mutation worldwide is 24%. A double mutation in the MTHFR is 7.7% of the world population. In North America, 31% of people have MTHFR, and European is 34%. So about a third of the population in the US or Europe, they actually have this and maybe they don't know it.
I have a question too. With that heavily involved with Europe and Asia, did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Is it more pronounced for people that immigrate or they migrate, like to different latitudes or different areas?
That's a great question. So genetically, I believe it's just in the European or Asian descent. Now it could cause different symptoms, maybe depending on your latitude, your exposure to the sun, different environmental factors. So you might end up having different issues depending on where you are with that mutation. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Great question. So with that, here's where my thoughts go. And I just think that there's not enough research on this area yet. And I would like to see research on this coming out. But kind of my take on it, or my hypothesis, if you would, if you have this PAI1 mutation, this is the clotting one. It's where, you know, you can't break down the fibrin clots very well because you just don't have the enzyme to do it. If you can't break down clots, We know that serotonin is released by platelets, and serotonin helps the tiny little arterioles in your body to narrow, and it's going to slow the blood flow. And that prevents clots from forming. So if evolution, has this individual that has a PAI mutation, it's going to prefer anything that lowers your serotonin levels, basically, because you don't want that serotonin to help clots to form because you already have an issue. You don't have your PAI1 enzyme. So let's say you're in this body with this PAI1 mutation. You're worried about clots. If you lower your serotonin levels, the clots don't form as much, which, I mean, clots are kind of a big deal. That could be life-ending. So that's a big deal to a human body. So let's say you're trying to slow down the serotonin. Your body's going to adjust to and by reducing the serotonin levels. And so interestingly, this is where I think the yeast comes in. If you have Candida albicans, so Candida yeast growing in your gut, Candida loves tryptophan. Okay, everything loves tryptophan. It is an essential amino acid. It's like if you could put yourself into the gut environment and just pretend you're a bacteria or a yeast, like everybody wants the food, everybody wants the space, everybody wants to fight off their enemies, right? So it's like this is the environment. Let's say the human eats a piece of tryptophan, maybe a big turkey dinner. The human wants that tryptophan for their body so that they can make serotonin, melatonin, all the things that the human body needs. But the bacteria is looking at the tryptophan saying, I want that. And the yeast is looking at it saying, I want that. So now it's a competition. Who gets the tryptophan? And I think that's where if you are an individual that has a lot of candida in your gut, maybe even what we would call an overgrowth of candida, it could be, and I don't know this, I haven't done this study, but it could be that the candida is out competing for the tryptophan. Or maybe you have bacterial growth, overgrowth, and then that's out competing and taking all the tryptophan where the human just doesn't get as much. So this could be one way that the human body almost, I don't know if you would say lets it happen or uses the yeast to help it. Like, hey, I've noticed that if I let this yeast overgrow in my gut, then I get less serotonin, which doesn't narrow my arterioles, and I don't get as many blood clots, right? So it could be a mechanism like that. I just think that needs to be investigated. The other thing about Candida that's interesting that I'll note here is that Candida also makes a product. And this product inhibits an inflammatory cytokine called interferon gamma. And so it could be that the human body kind of likes that. Like, hey, if I have more candida growing, it's going to start to tamp down on at least a part of my inflammation, which would be good for the human. So it's possible that the candida is allowed or, at least tolerated to grow or overgrow in the gut because big picture wise, that would potentially help the human. And then I guess you could look at, well, if it's not candida, it could be Malassezia, the other yeast that I mentioned at the beginning. So it just, I think that the human body, I'll put it this way. When you study biology, it's really cool because so there's so many patterns that you can see. And in the wild, many, many species like to eat yeast. And it's interesting because, like, if you look at the leafcutter ant, they are in the Amazon, and those are the little ants that carry those big leaves on their back. And you're like, wow, they're so strong. How do they carry that huge leaf, right? Well, they're not carrying the leaves back to their nest so that they can eat the leaf. That's not their goal. They're taking those leaves and putting it into their nest so that it will grow yeast. and ferment, and then they eat the yeast growing on the leaf, the dying, decaying leaf. So it's the yeast they're after. And then if you look at bees, they also use a fermentation product to decide if a bee is going to be the queen or the worker bee. And depending on the yeast in that pollen or the pollen type food that they eat, it determines what epigenetics turn on and change that bee into a worker or maintain it as a queen. So yeast is actually a signaling molecule in the animal world, and it helps to signal certain changes, epigenetic changes in the animals. And so if you look at that, and there's other examples I could give, those are just two, but if you look at that, you could think, maybe for the human, our gut is our little nest, or like in the ocean, it could be a tide pool where we are growing what we need for our health. Like, we're gonna let certain things grow in there because we actually need the products they make to keep our body healthy. And so that's the way I see it. I think it can be good for the body, but I think it can also, an overgrowth or too much can be bad and can also affect disease.
Okay. I don't know if this question is way off topic, but I'm just always curious because I've always heard that, or I haven't always heard, but more recently I've heard that fermented foods are the best thing for gut health.
Yeah.
What's the relationship with fermented foods and yeast?
That's a great question. So fermented foods have lactobacillus growing in them. And lactobacillus is acidic, or it makes a lactic acid, which is acidic. So the more you have in your gut, the more acidic your gut will be, which is tends to be a good thing. And it's your gut. So if you're a microbe, you like to live in a certain oxygen level and a certain pH level. And so it has to be just right for you to live there. If it's not just right, you're not going to live there. So pH actually determines what grows and what doesn't grow. So the more of this lactobacillus you eat, the more you're going to have an acidic environment around that bacteria. And that's going to promote the growth of certain healthy bacteria that you need for your body. So yeah, I would definitely say lactobacillus is a fantastic thing to eat. And if you don't mind, can I make a connection with birth here? So,
yeah.
Okay. So the cool thing about lactobacillus, this healthy bacteria, is they found that pregnant women in their last trimester will become enriched in the birth canal for lactobacillus. And so if the baby is born naturally and comes down through the birth canal, it will get all of this wonderful lactobacillus in its mouth, in its nose, and that will all go down and it will seed the gut. So the very first microbes that go into that baby's gut during the birth of that baby are lactobacillus. And then if you breastfeed your child, that milk, the sugars in the milk, are specifically designed to feed the lactobacillus. So if you're doing the birthing process the way that humans were made to be, it should all line up. It should all, the gut sets up correctly. It has lactobacillus. The milk nourishes the lactobacillus that grows. Now that baby is given this treasure for its lifetime on the very first day of its life. But sometimes the way that we do things interrupts that process. And so a baby that's born by C-section typically gets seeded with skin bacteria. That's the first bacteria that goes into their gut, not lactobacillus. And then if you don't nurse your baby and instead you feed it formula, that baby's now not getting the sugars and the so many other things in the mother's milk that is specifically designed to start them in a healthy way. So I think we really need to take a step back and look at how the birthing process in a modern society occurs. And I understand different mothers have different situations for sure. And this is not judgmental in any way. Because I definitely have friends and family members that have birthed their babies C-section, and it wasn't like a choice. They had to do it. So I get that. But I think we really need to consider the method of birth. If it's not like an emergency, maybe the mom should be educated better and saying, this is really why we do it this way. I think that antibiotics during the birthing process should be looked at. For example, certain mothers, well, before you give birth, sometimes if they find a certain streptococcus bacteria in the mother's birth canal, they will give her antibiotics for the last week or two right before she gives birth to eliminate that streptococcus. And there's a reason for it, but I think we have to look at the big picture and say, well, wait, why are we doing that for everybody? Like, maybe that should not be an across the board practice kind of thing. So I definitely think it's important to look at the birthing process and keep that as close to nature as we can.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause evolution provided us that.
Right.
And, you know, and it's not making any mistakes by doing so. It's provided us with what it needs to do.
It works.
I guess those there are those outliers, I guess, like you
yeah.
mentioned about.
Yeah, certainly.
But it's so common. It's so common now. It's just like convenience. We'll just schedule the C-section at this time.
Right. Right.
That's wild with the with how that gut lining happens and then the breast feeding.
Yeah, right.
It's just a lot of...
It's beautiful what a mother can give yeah. her baby on day one.
Yeah.
Yep. So let's, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about, let's see, is it Malassezia? Oh, no, we didn't talk about the Neanderthals yet.
Okay.
You want to
yeah,
go there?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do it. So recently there was a scientific paper published. I think originally the paper was 2024, but it became, it just kind of, at least it crossed through my email inbox maybe in May. It was May of this year. And it talked about how they looked at Neanderthal DNA and they've found certain Neanderthal genes that they're linking to autism spectrum. And I jumped on that because for a long time, I have wondered about the Neanderthal DNA. And anybody who's in the division of studying genetics, I'm sure this has been on their radar for a long time, probably much longer than me. But the interesting thing about Neanderthals is that they say that approximately 2% is in the human DNA. So every human has about 2% Neanderthal DNA in their genome. Some people a little bit less, some people a little bit more, depending on what area of the globe you're from. And I believe the Neanderthals, if you look into it, they were living in this main area, I wanna say in Spain, like near the Gibraltar, Rock of Gibraltar. In that area, there was like a cave where there was a pretty large population. So it kind of came from that area and spread. And so they interacted with Homo sapiens, humans, and it crossed over. So interestingly, they say that Neanderthals had red hair and blue eyes, which when I learned about that, I was pretty shocked. I actually did not know that. But where that becomes interesting is the story of melanin. And so you've talked about this before in your podcast, but there's different forms of melanin. And there's the pheomelanin, which is like the red tint that you have if you have reddish hair, you know, light colors, light color eyes, all of that. And then there's the eumelanin, which is the brownish, darker pigment. That you would find in like the brown eyes or browner shades of hair and stuff. So these different shades of melanin actually turn out to be pretty important. And this is where I think I think that they're onto something, that this Neanderthal DNA may be connected to certain pathways in the human body that are important to the autism community.
Yeah, I think so too. Melanin is definitely underrated, especially just as a protective, what it's doing as a protective role.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think I had learned that on your podcast about how it scavenges the reactive oxygen species from UV light.
Yeah. It's a massive protector. It might be our top protection, I think.
Right.
Is with the melanin, and it's a it absorbs. It's huge for transferring like biological energy.
Yes.
It's a like transduction. And that's why, because it's like that darker melanin is you know, it just absorbs everything. But I don't know. That's like more quantum stuff that's not really mainstream, I don't think. Not like it should be.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and then, you know, it's we have the melan or melanocytes, the three types of melanocytes, and then the three types of melanin. The neuromelanin is so important, in especially the brainstem area.
Yes.
That deep inside the brain, like where the brain evolved out of, it's huge there. The neuromelanin is so big.
And then there's diseases like Parkinson's.
Yeah. And substantia nigra, of course, is black because of the neuromelanin.
Right.
The locus coeruleus as well. And we can connect tyrosine to all of that too, because we were talking about those neurotransmitters and methionine and SAM and so forth. But yeah, we can get back to the Neanderthals though.
Okay.
Is there anything else like from that study? Because that was published in Nature, a very good journal. So,
right.
I know that they talked about. This gene, see, I'm not great at genes, but SLC22A10, which helps encode proteins for transporting anions and cations across the plasma membrane and the cell membrane, which is pretty important, I think, in autistics. You know, just that cell health.
Yes, and mitochondria function.
Yeah.
For sure. They found several Neanderthal genes. From what I read, it wasn't just like one, but I'll read, like, I put a few little notes down from this article.
Go ahead.
Yeah, they said Neanderthal genes may increase your risk of depression. They're involved in certain skin lesions like actinic keratosis. They're involved in blood clots and hypercoagulation, which we talked about today. Actually, the good part is they boost your immune response. So they actually found that these genes help you to defend against fungi. They are also involved in the development of skin and hair, which I think is interesting when you consider melanin and how different hair and skin types can be different colors. They're involved in urinary tract infections, the transport of vitamin B1, which helps to metabolize carbohydrates in the gut. And then they're involved in nicotine addiction. So we definitely have to keep an eye on this and like, hey, wait a minute, what is the Neanderthal DNA doing as far as human health goes? Because maybe back in the day, it helped the Neanderthals. It was actually like good for them to have these genes, but our life looks very different now. We eat different foods. We live in different regions of the world. We have artificial light. You know, there's a lot that's changed, and maybe now it's maladaptive to have some of these genes. So I think it needs to be considered for sure.
Yeah.
One thing I would like to say before I forget about the melanin part, if you don't mind. So you had mentioned about the substantia nigra and how that has the darker pigment from the melanin. And like Parkinson's disease, that substantia nigra area gets lighter and lighter as the disease goes on. The melanin actually is reduced in that area of the brain. But interestingly, remember at the beginning, I mentioned that yeast Malassezia furfur? So that one makes melanin.
Okay. Does it? Okay.
Yeah. And it actually uses the same pathway, the tyrosine to DOPA to melanin. Same pathway. Yeah. So this is where I think, what if the human doesn't have enough melanin? So, well, we've got this yeast living on our skin and potentially in our gut and other parts of the body. What if we can use this yeast to make melanin for us? Because where this yeast occurs, they find darker pigments around the yeast as it eats and it produces melanin. So I don't know. I think it's an area that needs to be researched. I think it would intersect with Parkinson's disease and other things. And personally, and this is a debated idea, so I'll put that out there. I personally believe that this yeast could get into the brain and live there, potentially undetected by the immune system, or at least enough where it's allowed to live there by the human body. I don't fully know. Some people believe that the body, especially the brain, is protected and does not have organisms, microorganisms living in it. But there was a study in 2018, actually from the school I went to and finished my PhD, where a professor, she was in neuroscience, and her student found these little rod, tiny rod shapes on the slides of brain tissue that they were looking at. And the student said, "What is this? I don't recognize this. It's not a part of the brain. It's not a brain structure." And the professor, she was like, "Yeah, I don't know what that is either." And they actually looked at all 32 slices of brains, and that was in all 32 samples. And the way they figured it out is that they invited a professor from the Department of Microbiology to come look at their slides and say, "What is this?" And he said, "Oh, that's bacteria." And they're like, "Wait, what? Bacteria in the brain?" And he's like, "Yeah, that's Bacillus right there. It looks just like Bacillus." And then they had to go through and make sure they had not contaminated their, you know, slide prep materials. You know, maybe it was growing in the gel that they used to make the slides. And it wasn't in there. It was actually a part of all of the brains. And they presented this in a neuroscience meeting. And it was kind of a mic drop moment where everybody in the meeting was like, "Wait, what? Excuse me." So, like I said, it's debated. Some people say no way, it's impossible. Other people say, yeah, it's in there. There's microbes living in the brain. So who knows? I think that's also interesting.
I wonder if it's the amount of inflammation and immune problems now, if that blood-brain barrier is opening up. And I know like vasopressin, I think, is involved with that, and that's connected to autism, and I wonder if just our, you know, because autoimmune problems are skyrocketing and everybody's inflamed, at least to some degree, if it's opening up that blood-brain barrier. Because I was, at first I was wondering if these brain slices was maybe that person just had a lot of inflammation or immune problems, or maybe not.
Yeah,
I don't know though.
Well, and when they looked at it further, I think this may have been another group, I can't remember, but the type of bacteria that they found in the brain samples was the same type of bacteria that was predominant in the gut of that person. So potentially they think that, you've probably heard of leaky gut, where, you know, They think your gut is leaky and potentially some of the bacteria or microbes that should stay in the gut maybe are leaking out, spreading through the body. You know, I think that's being researched. So that could be a potential source.
Okay. Earlier you mentioned everything loves tryptophan, and you mentioned some synthesis with like the melanin and things. I can't help but ask, like on the epidermis, we have those melanocytes, and then we have keratinocytes.
Yeah.
And within the keratinocytes, TPH1 is very heavy, tryptophan hydroxylase 1. Yeah. Is there some sort of interaction with yeast going on there?
I think that's potentially, yeast needs tryptophan.
Yeah, okay.
It needs to be studied.
Yeah, okay.
And then,
because I'm very fascinated with TPH1 as it's involved with the maternal side.
Okay.
And then the placenta and then the fetal providing those nutrients and so forth. That's why I was just wondering about that.
Well, and I think it would be interesting to look at people who are albinos. And so they don't have melanin. And so then you, like, questions I've asked before, okay, what diseases are they not getting because they don't have melanin? Or what diseases do they commonly get because they don't have melanin? And so I think it would be pretty easy to set up even like a study where you're looking at people with no melanin or maybe reduced melanin or pheomelanin instead of eumelanin, and then look at people that have extra melanin or higher levels, and like, how does this compare to what diseases they're getting, what yeast lives on their body, in their body? Like, you know, it needs to be looked at. I am not aware of a study that has been done on that yet.
Okay. I do know that melanin is very good with anti-aging, because we're losing our ability to make water in cytochrome C oxidase, but that melanin will rescue that. And then we're creating more free electrons.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's
cool.
Yeah, that's 100% true. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so like just increasing your melanin will help you age.
Yeah.
Because cytochrome C oxidase is breaking down because we're not making water. If we just reverse engineer the electron transport chain, you know, cytochrome C oxidase is the last step until ATPase.
Yes.
And then we're just losing biological energy, essentially. And then we can just backtrack that through all the cytochromes and the TCA cycle and so forth. It's just, I don't know.
Interesting.
It's like, I don't think we go far enough upstream whenever we're talking about things. Maybe by design, I don't know.
I understand.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
But it is very, I love this stuff.
Yeah.
I've learned so much so far. Yeah. What else was there?
Let's see. We talked about the yeast, the melanin, Neanderthals.
The yeast is fascinating stuff.
Oh, you know what we didn't talk about? The manganese. We started out with that at the beginning.
I took a note of that.
Yeah, it was the manganese. Okay, so here's the interesting part about manganese. And so the reason why I think it's important in autism spectrum is that you have this epigenetics thing going on in the body where outside environmental factors can influence which genes are turned on or turned off. And it doesn't even have to change the DNA base. All it has to do is methylate or tag the top of the DNA or not. And so things like, you know, what you're exposed to, chemicals, you know, carcinogens, whatever, all of that can affect epigenetics. Well, turns out manganese is really important in the body, and in the gut, manganese keeps your gut hypoxic, right? So meaning low levels of oxygen. Because manganese will scavenge some of the oxygen and keep the levels down. A hypoxic gut is a healthy gut. I know it's different from other parts of your body. But in the gut, you do not want to have high levels of oxygen because it promotes yeast growth, Candida albicans growth. So there are certain bacteria that are healthy in your gut. And the reason they're healthy is they're keeping that gut environment hypoxic. They're keeping the oxygen levels low. Well, if you don't have manganese, or for some reason your body is, you know, keeping the manganese away from the gut or whatever's happening, because sometimes, you know, your body can take metals and kind of hoard them away so that it kills the pathogen you're being infected with. That does happen. So we don't know if it's that, or another potential place where this could be happening is that when we spray our food with glyphosate, glyphosate is something that in the soil, it strips a plant of manganese, interestingly. And we're spraying glyphosate on a lot of our common crops throughout the central U.S., commonly corn, soy, you know, things like that. And actually, the plants are worse for it. They are not as nutritious, but they don't have the manganese that they need. And so potentially, if this were to be ingested by a human, do we know the effects of a chemical that strips manganese? Does it strip manganese in our gut? I don't know. Right? We've been told that the studies were done and glyphosate does not harm the human cells. But does it harm the microbiome? Does it harm the bacteria? Does it harm the yeast in the gut? Does it change the oxygen levels in the gut so that we now have a yeast overgrowth, which then causes different effects or symptoms in the human body? So I think that that part needs to be looked at, manganese, because it's shifting the oxygen levels in the gut.
Okay. I wrote down a question here, and I don't know if I want to ask it as specific as I wrote it down or just more general, but I'll just ask it as I wrote it down. Is the hypoxia because it is better for the smaller prokaryotic cells, like the lower oxygen?
So when the gut is hypoxic, it keeps the candida yeast from growing as well. So you have lower yeast levels. And it also alters certain bacterial species. So it will like upregulate, I have the paper, I think it said E. coli, a certain type of E. coli, and there was one other, maybe Clostridia. Anyways, there's two bacterial species that it promotes, like they grow more, and then the candida grows less. And that is a healthier gut, a hypoxic or low oxygen gut.
Those first two things that you mentioned is big in autism research.
The bacteria?
The E. coli.
Clostridia.
Not E. coli. Yes.
The Clostridia. Yeah.
E. coli. Yeah.
That's a cool one, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
When does yeast form, like in the human living organism, like through embryogenesis, or when does it come on board?
That's a great question. So that goes back to a debate as to whether or not there are microbes in the placenta and in the womb. Some people or scientists believe it's sterile. Some believe that there are microbes in the womb with the baby. So it depends on kind of where you land with that, but let's pretend or say that it's sterile. Let's say that the first exposure to microbes is the day of your birth, and either through the birth canal or through the skin for a C-section. So the way nature made it is that the baby would go through the birth canal and pick up lactobacillus, but also some yeast. I mean, that's just a normal inhabitant of the human. So I would say on day one, you're getting yeast. I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily to get yeast. I think it can be helpful. I think yeast overgrowth is the problem. And so for example, I'm friends with certain farmers that are trying to really do a wonderful job of maintaining soil health for their plants because they want the microbes that are living in their soil to be just right so that the plant takes up all the nutrients from the soil and it's the healthiest possible product that they can make to feed the humans. And what they look at, it's not whether or not there's bacteria and yeast in the soil, it's the ratio. So, like, do we have enough bacteria and enough yeast, but not too much, so that everything in the soil lives and it's a healthy living ecosystem? And I would say our gut is exactly the same way. It's our dirt. It's our garden. You want some bacteria and you want some yeast. You don't want overgrowth. You want the healthy products they're making to feed the nutrients to the human, but you don't want it to be out of control where now it's like trying to take over or spread, you know? So.
Okay. The gut, it's like I always think of the gut as, and I shouldn't say I statements, but to me, it's I'm like the gut brain predates this big complex human brain because we had to extract all these nutrients and be healthy in the gut way before we had to do, this part of the brain stuff, like planning and just like navigating and surviving really, because that was survival for us way before this. Yeah, so the
Actually,
gut is very
in Eastern medicine, a lot of times they'll call the gut your first brain, and your brain is
Yeah,
your
that's
second
what.
brain.
Yeah, yeah. The gut and the heart, I think, even. The heart is. And then, the
Well,
human brain is very
and
fascinating.
it's all connected by the vagus nerve, cranial nerve 10, which picks up signals from several different organs, including the gut. It kind of, connects to the nervous system, that your enteric nervous system that goes around your gut. So all of these signals that are coming from your gut, even neuromodulators and stuff, can send signals through the vagus nerve.
Yeah, it's a big communication. They're definitely it's a big communication, and it seems like through embryogenesis they're all connected though. Like I don't know if the enteric nervous system comes from neuroepithelial or if there's a different one. I think it's a different one,
Yeah, I don't
but
know actually. I need to look
the
that up.
neurulation, yeah, the neurulation has a like there's four cell types and then one of them are neuroepithelial and it's like connecting like the GI and the central nervous system, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But and that goes all back to the environment and everything and the mother's gut health and the mother's physiology and our modern environments not being as optimal as they were for evolution. But wow, I learned so much. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you think is salient?
Oh, that's good. Gosh. I think that, maybe this leads to the next conversation, and maybe not with me, but whoever, that can talk about foods that you can eat to keep your gut healthy and lifestyle choices like exercise and different things, and the impact that those things have on your gut. Because really, I think if you view bacteria and yeast as, ooh, they're bad, kill it, that's really the wrong way to look at things. I think that most of them are healthy. Most of them are here for our bodies to help our bodies. And I think you need to feed them and keep them happy so that they keep you happy. And I think that needs to be paid attention to because there's things in our modern diet, they call the standard American diet the SAD diet. There are things in there that kill the good bacteria and the good yeast. And it's sad because like it's almost like when something goes extinct, it's extinct. Like you don't get it back. You killed it. You killed every single living member of that population. It doesn't come back. So antibiotics, certain chemicals in our foods, even what was I going to say? Yeah, just preservatives, everything you add to your food, it's doing things to your gut. And when it's gone, it's gone. You don't just get it back. So I think it's important to consider that. So yeah, I think it leads to more conversations.
Yeah. Can you define bifidobacteria? Is that like complex or no?
It's not bifido. That is one that they've linked to happiness, that bifido really promotes a feeling of happiness and well-being in a person. And bifido is a bacteria that's one of the first ones that starts your gut off when you're a baby. So actually, it is almost, we call it an immature gut when you have a lot of bifido. It's like a baby in the first 2, 3 years of life, they'll have a lot of bifidobacteria. But then their gut will change as they age, and it starts to, your gut ages naturally, and that you'll see kind of a shift in species. And then when you're in your older years, then there's even further shifting, and you're going to go more towards Bacteroides and some other bacteria. So you can kind of tell a person's age by what is living there. And bifido is a baby. One that we find in babies. And actually, autism spectrum, they do say, is an immature gut, that it just doesn't quite develop past a certain point. And they really say that the first 1,000 days of life, it's this window of time that you have to establish your gut. It's basically 3 years. So when that baby turns 3 years old, that's when it's kind of sealed and done. Any changes you wanted to make in that gut, you kind of ran out of time by age 3. And kind of what's there is there, and that's what they get. So the first 3 years of life are crucial for, trying to keep that gut as healthy as possible and considering what foods that child is eating, what antibiotics they're getting, any kind of chemical exposure, things like that. You want to look at those 3 years of life.
I look at the ingredient list of formula, and there's like 90 ingredients, it looks like. It's like, it seems nefarious to me.
It's not ideal.
No, it's not ideal.
And then if you further consider the antibodies that the mom is giving her child through the milk, I mean, there's nothing that's equal, just nothing equal.
Wow. Bifidobacteria is heavily attached to autism.
Yes.
And well, like some of the vaccines are I know it's touchy, but they're destroying this biology that we're talking about. It's destroying them is what it looks like.
I think everything should be considered, especially in the first 3 years of life. We should be looking at it and saying, okay, what is this doing to the gut?
What's something recently that you're most excited about?
Oh, great question. You're gonna probably like this one. I'm actually working on starting a podcast of my own.
Oh, good.
So I want to talk about gut health. And it's going to be called Right in the Gut. So I'm getting started. We'll see where it goes. Right now I'm teaching, so that is my day job. It pays the bills. But in my extra time, I'd love to teach about gut health because I just love it. And I find that people, they might not have an outlet really where they're hearing some of this. And I think it seems to be that they appreciate it. So yeah. That's coming next. So
Wow.
maybe you can.
That's a great.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. Maybe you can be my first follower.
Yeah, I'll definitely follow.
Okay.
I learned so much today. And, because this is an area that I haven't navigated a whole lot, just kind of surface level stuff.
Sure.
I get in rabbit holes and sometimes I don't come out of them. So I got to watch
We
it.
all do. Same.
Yeah, so good.
Same.
Yeah. Well, Yeah, good luck with the podcast and stuff.
Thanks.
And you should definitely do it because you can tell that you love it. And we should do more things that we love in
I
life.
agree. I agree.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Why?
Anything else before we wrap up?
No, but I sure have enjoyed talking to you and being here to share with your listeners, and I hope somebody got something out of it.
Yeah, I think they will. This is such good information. Well, have a good day.
Okay, you too. Take care. Bye bye.
Bye.